Hi, I'm Daniel Enzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. On today's episode, I speak with Tim Carroll, also known as TC, Artistic Director of the Shaw Festival Theater in Niagara-on-the-Lake in Ontario, Canada. The Shaw Festival was named for George Bernard Shaw, an influential Irish playwright and critic known for his wit, social commentary, and prolific body of work that challenged societal norms. With a commitment to high-quality productions and innovative storytelling, the Shaw Festival has become a cherished institution, welcoming both local and international visitors and audiences. Tim Carroll began his career with the English Shakespeare Company and was associate director of the Northcote Theatre in Exeter. From 1999 to 2005, he was associate director of Shakespeare's Globe in London. His Tony-nominated Globe productions of Richard III and Twelfth Night earned ecstatic raves in the New York Times and the New Yorker. Since 2017, Carroll has been the artistic director of Canada's Shaw Festival. Now, TC and I had originally planned for half an hour to talk, but he was so generous with his time and answers, this is a supersized episode. He also talks about every title that the Shaw Festival is producing in 2024, which is an incredible insider's guide to the festival. I'm so interested to see all of the shows with the season pass he mentions, and then come back and listen to what he said about them. If you would like to see any of the shows at the festival or purchase a season pass, you can get more information at shawfest.com. Now, here's my interview with TC. Great. Today we are here with Timothy Carroll, also known as TC from the Shaw Festival. How are you today, TC?
I'm very well, thank you, Daniel. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Excellent. So for our listeners who may not know, could you give a brief description of the Shaw Festival and what it is?
Well, I'm happy to say that a brief description is getting more and more difficult to achieve because we're doing more and more different things, but we are fundamentally a theatre festival. We used to run only in the summer, but now we also have some winter programming, and we do very high quality, intelligent drama. We are named for Bernard Shaw. But we do a lot more than Bernard Shaw plays. We usually do one or two Shaw plays in each season, but we also do a musical and comedies and hard-hitting new plays. And the common thread with all of the plays we do is simply that they appeal to the head as well as the heart.
Thank you. I think that is very true, kind of being able to have attended the Shaw Festival for many, many years now. This diversity of programming and what's being offered is really amazing, that you can get kind of a musical in previous seasons like Damn Yankees, and then an amazing drama like The Amen Corner, or a contemporary piece like Everybody. The Shaw Festival really does have something for everybody.
Well, I don't know if we have something for everybody, because of course it's always difficult to be made aware of, oh yes, there's plays from that tradition that we haven't done yet. But at the same time, I try not to beat myself up about it too much. We have to make sure that we do what we're good at, and we are very good at 20th century drama. We're very good at comedies and musicals. We are very good at providing a lot of fun around our plays. You know, that's why we got our Spiegel tent going this year, is to make sure that people who come to the Shaw don't just see a play.
Excellent. What did you do before you came to the Shaw Festival?
I've always been a director, which is quite unusual among my contemporaries. If I think of the people that I was at university with at Oxford, I'm the only one doing what I set out to do. They've all moved on to their second and third careers and are all making a lot more money and are all perfectly happy. So I'm not boasting when I say that. I think it says something about my lack of imagination. But I was always a theatre director. My main job before I came here, although I've always really been a freelance and worked all over the world, my main job was at the Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in London, where I was associate artistic director for 7 years.
Wow, that's amazing. And so many amazing productions came out of that space. Was there a play there that you felt like, ah, this is it, or I found my voice, or I feel like this is a show that really encapsulates kind of what I do really well?
Yes and no. One of the things that I noticed was that when I tried to do something very new and experimental, all my friends would say, "Oh, yes, that's very Carol. That's a very TC show." And I'd go, "Really? I thought I was breaking new ground." Oh, bugger. So I don't know. You never do encapsulate everything, but I did have some favorites. Of course, I did a Twelfth Night at the Globe, which became quite famous because it went to the West End and Broadway and won lots of awards. But I also did a production called The Golden Ass, which is an adaptation of the Apuleius novel from Roman times, and Mark Rylance played the lead in it. It's never really been done again because it is a crazy, baggy play, but I really loved working on it. It did say something about the kind of theatre I like because it was funny and serious and sacred and profane, and it had music and it had puppets and it had cowboys riding around on scooters. You know, it was kind of everything I like to see on stage in one go.
Wonderful. You are the artistic director of the Shaw Festival. Is that your correct title?
Yes.
So I'm interested to know, right? And of course, I'm not asking for a job description, but in a nutshell, what would you say the job of an artistic director is?
Your main job, I suppose, in a public-facing way, is to select which plays get done and who directs them. And that does take a certain amount of my time. I spend more of my time after that point casting the plays, deciding who plays in them. That's a very long, complicated, arduous process. And of course, behind the headline of choosing the plays to put on is an enormous amount of fielding inquiries and pitches from people who say, "I've got this great idea to do this play." And of course, because most of the time you say no, a lot of your job as an artistic director is just crushing people's dreams.
Or reframing them, or certainly. When you read plays, and I'm sure you have to read a number of them to create a season, what is it about a play that, let's say, or a musical that grabs you or says, "You must do me now"?
What does grab you about a play? It's a very good question because plays come into the season either from the list that I've had in my head for years and years and years, from well before I came here, or they suddenly zoom in at the last moment because you have a problem and they solve it. And I think in all of these cases, the rather subjective but to me very clear distinguishing feature is that the language of the play has to really make me thrilled. It has to make me go, "Oh, that's good. Oh, I couldn't have written that." You know, when I read a play by Will Eno or Brandon Jacobs Jenkins or Tom Stoppard or Carol Churchill, the actual taste of the language in your mouth is intoxicating.
I would agree. And I think you see that across all of Shaw's stages. I'm thinking about sort of so much that I've seen there. And you are entering kind of a different world when you go into any one of those spaces at the festival campus, where you can see something in the afternoon that might be a period drama and then something that's incredibly contemporary in the evening. And that's a really special thing about the festival.
It is really special that we have so many different ways of thrilling an audience. It does allow you a certain leeway in thinking, well, okay, I can't do that play in the George, but I can do it in the studio. I can't do that event in any of our theatres because it's not going to sit right, or it'll be too marginal, too quirky, may not attract enough of an audience, maybe it's too short to do in one of the theatres. But then I can say, well, why don't we do it in the Spiegel tent instead? So that's one of the fun things as well, is curating that experience for the audience, putting together a really nice menu or something. You know, I do think in a way it's very akin to being a sort of a restaurateur, that I'm trying to create an experience which is really sort of delightful from the moment you arrive, even from the moment you phone up to book your table. You know that all every dish that arrives should be wonderful. The choice of dishes should be almost impossible. You should have, you know, it's a sign of a good restaurant, isn't it, when you're just agonizing because you know how good the duck is going to be, but you really want the liver and onions, you know. So I like that, that sense of doing what you do, you know, when you organize a surprise party or something, you are second guessing someone's behavior and their reactions, and you're working out how to lead them to this moment when they'll open the door and everyone will leap out and go surprise. Which is a strange analogy for me to use because I think I hate surprise parties more than anything else in the world. But I like organizing parties for other people, not surprise ones, but you know what I mean.
I do. I'd love to sort of press the chef on how the menu is made to extend the metaphor and ask, like, when you are organizing a season, do you think, oh, this is an anchor piece here, or we have this here, or is it a little bit more organic? I'd love to know how the process comes together.
I think it's the process is very, is like everything in life, and certainly like everything in art, which is it's a negotiation between the fixed and the flowing.
Hmm.
So certain things are fixed, like there's only so many hours in the day. There's only so many shows you can do in each venue. There's only so much money you can spend. There's a certain amount of money you need to make or you're going to go out of business. All of these things are moderately fixed. And so how you solve those problems flows a little bit, but again, it flows to varying degrees. It would be very difficult now to imagine a Shaw season that didn't have a big musical from the point of view of the box office. Mm-hmm. And also from the point of view of, it brings in a lot of people who wouldn't otherwise come to the Shaw, the musical. And whether or not they book for something else, of course, I hope they book for another show as well. But even if it just brings them to one, well, then they came. And the same goes for a Christmas Carol that we do in the winter. Every single year, the majority of the audience have never been to the Shaw before. Now, we track the extent to which they keep coming back, and they do, some of them, but some of them, maybe that's the only time they come each year. Maybe they start making that a tradition. Anyway, I digress. The anchor points of the season there are certain ones that are pretty much immovable. We have to have a musical. We have always had at least one Bernard Shaw play, and I think that's a nice rule that we set ourselves. There's plenty of good ones, and our audience contains a great many Shavians, real sort of Shaw hardcore fans, and I'm one myself, so I...
Count me among the list, yes.
Yeah, Apple Cart this year was an absolutely fabulous production.
Brilliant.
Many people's favorite. So we have to do those too. We certainly have to find a big popular, probably comedy for the festival, because that's not an easy space to fill with 800 seats. We have to find at least one offering that people can bring their kids to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are certain things like that. And then there are certain other considerations which have to be taken into account, but which can be dealt with in various ways, like it would be very strange and dangerous of me to have a season where every single piece was written by a white man.
Mm-hmm.
So I look to make sure that people who are not white men don't just look at it and go, oh, okay, oh, so people who look like me or are built like me are not worthy of having even a single play in your program. Now, if I was running a theater that was devoted to new writing, that would take care of itself because the vast majority of new plays are written by women. But when you do have a kind of, it's not a mandate, but when you have a specialism in a period such as we do, which is sort of 1890 to 1960, Of course, that's just before the great explosion of female playwrights. And of course, we don't stick to it for that reason. And we present people like Carol Churchill and so on. From later on, Helen Edmondson this year, her marvelous play, The Clearing, was one of my highlights. But it's a factor that I need to take into account quite early in my thinking so that I don't end up going, oh crap, look at that. Look at that very, very white male season.
Well, I also want to say, I think going along with that, one of the most incredible things perhaps I've ever seen in my life was this year's Mahabharata, the sort of two-part play that took place that's based upon the ancient Indian epic. And it sort of it contains parts of the Bhagavad Gita and was just an incredible, incredible experience at the Shaw. And I understand that that play also went to London in both parts. Is there any chance that we might see it again? Is it sort of still in the works somewhere?
It's certainly still in the works. It is... There is a plan for it to do another tour in 25. Now that we've launched it, the way we set up the deal with Why Not Theatre Company, with whom we co-produced it, was for every reason, for their sake as well as ours, that once they take it away from here, it's their baby and we don't have any more financial investment in it, and we don't make any money off it either. So to that extent, it's totally up to them how much it carries on. I know they want it to carry on, and I know that many festivals sent representatives to the Shore to watch it, and they were all, of course, hugely impressed. So I think it's very likely that it will get onto that international festival circuit.
Fantastic. It's like so much I've seen this year, sort of mind blowing, and just has stayed with me.
Good.
I would love to kind of go back to something you said earlier about maybe delighting audiences. And one of the things that I find so delightful at the Shaw Festival is the way that it's casting, something that you sort of mentioned as part of your job, in that actors at the Shaw Festival appear in multiple roles and often very different roles across the season. I'd love for you to share with our listeners maybe what that process is like or how it works or just even maybe some of the fun of that process.
I'm not just being an Eeyore when I say it is no fun at all.
Well, or fun for an audience is a huge headache. Behind the scenes, a huge headache. Yeah, but the result is
fun. Yeah, the process is like doing 17 Sudokus at the same time, and also making decisions where you go, oh, that works. Oh, now we've got nothing for so and so. Oh no, that's awful. They did really good work this year. How am I going to tell him he doesn't have a job next year? Oh, I feel terrible. And then the day before you're going to tell them, someone else says no to an offer and you go, oh God, good thing I didn't tell him he does have a job. You know, so I don't like that puppet master bit.
Of course not.
I don't like having people's careers and livelihoods in my hands, especially not now when, the economy is bad and people are worried. It's no joke to someone to be told, sorry, don't have anything for you next year. But I'm at the stage now in casting for 25, which is the nicer bit where I can just look at it in a rather sort of restoration fop sort of way and go, sink me, stab me vitals. Which of these fine gentlemen and ladies will play this part best? The first thing we have to do is work out what we call the cross, which is not every play can play at the same time as every other play, obviously. If we're going to have a show in the festival, then we have to have at least one show that can play in the George at the same time as it, which means that those shows must not cross. They can't share any actors or stage managers or anything. And since we often, in the height of the season, have three shows happening at the same time, we have to make sure that the plays don't cross too much. In fact, I won't go into the maths of it, mainly because I don't understand them.
But it
makes sense for each play to share its cast or give some of its cast to two other plays, sometimes three, never more than three. If it shares actors with four plays, you're going to get into a real pickle, because you can never schedule rehearsals or performances. And if it only shares with one, which we do sometimes, sometimes there's a what we call a tight cross where the same company does two plays. That seems attractive, but it means that they rehearse, they need longer to rehearse because they can never rehearse in each other's cracks. And they always have to play separately. They can never play against each other. So it also, for reasons too boring to go into, a very tight cross makes understudying quite hard. So we try to avoid a cross with one. We go for a cross with two or three as the sweet spot, and we try to avoid a cross with four. But then when we've got a cross, we have to start experimenting with, are the kind of people we need for this play, if four of them need to be in this play, can it provide four? And we go, yes, it can provide four, but oh, look, the other four need to go to that play, and that play can't take any of those four because they're wrong for that play. Crap. And sometimes it's as simple as there's too many women, too many men. Sometimes it's like, no, we need kids for that show, and everyone that gets left over from this one working is over 50, so that's no good. So then we scrap that cross and start again and go, okay, so what? And again, that's another reason why two or three plays that you're crossing with gives you a bit more breathing room to be able to go. And indeed, sometimes now, because we have a Spiegel tent, it gives us a bit more breathing room as well, because we can say, that actor doesn't really cross into either of those plays. Why don't we keep him in reserve and make him an MC for our variety show in the Spiegel tent, something like that. But we can't do too much of that, because then the numbers start bloating and you go, oh, we've got 100 actors and the budget is impossible.
Right.
So there's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of third, fourth, fifth versions before it starts to work. And then, as I say, you have this very torturous and tortuous process whereby you think, okay, we can't offer that part yet because that actor might be needed to play that role if so-and-so says no. So you have to start, not necessarily at the top of the biggest parts, but you have to start with the hardest to replace parts and go, and I cannot offer, so, you know, I cannot offer anyone else almost anything in My Fair Lady until I know Tom Rooney is doing Henry Higgins.
Right.
Because if Tom Rooney says no, then one of them probably plays Henry Higgins, or even more annoyingly, that guy I have in the farce probably plays Henry Higgins, so that casting falls apart in that play. So you literally have to go one actor at a time, because the butterfly wing effect throughout all the casting can be chaotic and can be calamitous. You can sometimes find yourself with the whole house of cards collapsing, and you go, oh crap, I wish I hadn't already offered that person, because I should have given myself room for maneuver there, you know. So thank you for triggering the trauma that I live with.
I'm sorry. Well, hopefully the next question won't be as traumatic. I'd love to start kind of talking through the 2024 season and just sort of saying kind of what's available for our listeners to get tickets to. Let's start with the Festivals Theater, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is the biggest theater on the Shaw campus. It's a proscenium style stage, which most people are kind of used to. When they think of a theater, they think of a proscenium style stage. And the first sort of the big musical that will be at the festival stage is My Fair Lady, directed by you and co-directed with Kimberly Rampersand.
Rampersad.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize.
Yes, everyone does that because of the similarity to ampersand, but it's Rampersad, not sand.
Thank you.
I'm sure you will interview her one day, so I want to save you a predestinate space, as they say. Yeah. Yes, we're doing My Fair Lady, and that is the aforementioned big musical in the festival. You're right that the festival is our biggest theatre. It holds 800. Our next biggest is the George, which holds 300. They're both prosceniums. And then our studio holds about 270. And at the moment it's configured in the round, although we could change that in the future if we wanted to. So My Fair Lady, of course, is a kind of golden piece for us because it is also a shore piece. So we kill two birds with one stone. And it really fulfills the criterion, which is not impossible, but challenging with musicals, which is for them to pass the test of, is the language really brilliant? Does the actual dialogue or the words of the songs make me go, oh, that's good, I couldn't have written that. And of course, My Fair Lady does, because it takes so much of Pygmalion word for word. And, you know, Gypsy was a good example this year of something where the book would work very well as a play. It's a brilliant piece of writing anyway. So My Fair Lady is a golden piece. They were talking about doing it at Stratford, which is our friendly rival theatre down the road. But luckily I'm friends with the artistic director there, and because he's Italian, he understood what it was to be made an offer he couldn't refuse. And I just made it clear that we were doing My Fair Lady, and actually it was much less impressive than that. I sort of cried and wailed and whined and said,
oh, come on.
No, I did, because they've got a huge theatre.
Yeah.
So if they do My Fair Lady, if they go to the rights holders will let them do it rather than us, because they'll make a lot more money out of it. There's so I had to sort of, I had to whine and say, look, you've got Twelfth Night, As You Like It, Romeo and Juliet, Midsummer Night's Dream, all these plays that you can do every 5 years and write yourself a check for $3 million. We don't have anything like that here. We don't have a single nailed on banker except My Fair Lady. So keep your hands off it. And he went, yeah, all right.
Well, that's amazing. And, you know, I also love, too, one of the things at the Shaw that I think you kind of wrote about, I think a little bit in this sort of short interview with you that was in the sort of program or the playbill kind of at the top. It was handed out at every single show this year, was that you really investigate these musicals or treat them as if they're plays. It's wonderful to see kind of the text in the musical, the libretto and the book come alive at the Shaw, which sometimes, you know, doesn't necessarily happen. So I'm so excited to see what the both of you do with My Fair Lady.
We're very excited. We're looking forward to having some good old rows, you know, as co-directors. I think the cast are all very scared of what's going to happen if mum and dad start fighting in front of them, but and we intend to show them. We're both very big Shaw fans. The big difference between us is that Kimberly knows musicals inside out. I mean, literally from the inside, as a dancer and performer and brilliant director herself. Whereas I have hardly ever directed a musical. What I've done a lot of is opera. I've directed about 30 operas. So I agree that with the notion you mentioned that you actually have no choice but to treat it as a play. I don't really know any other way of directing. All I can do as a director is say some version of, why don't I believe you? And then the answer to that question is somehow going to help you play with more conviction. And really, I'm always doing that in plays. I'm always just saying, what would it be like if you meant that, you know? And the actors go, what? I did mean it. And I go, okay, if you say so. And then they go, oh, I didn't, did I? And I go, well, I just call them as I see them. And, you know, and they go, oh, bugger, all right. And then they mean it. And everyone goes, oh, that was good. And they go, all right, then. So really, you know, this is why I do love my job. It's a bit of my job that I love is making actors unhappy.
To be better, right? Everyone needs an obstacle to kind of press ahead to the goal. So that's what is needed. Yep.
Let's say that. Let's say it's not just sadism. You know.
I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I don't think you'd be there if it was total sadism. Also on the Festival Theater stage is the brilliant comedy One Man, Two Governors and Sherlock Holmes, The Mystery of the Human Heart. Any insights or kind of exciting tidbits you could offer to our audience about those?
Well, Well, we're very excited to be doing One Man, Two Governors. I was amazed to discover it's never been done in this part of the world at all. Never been done in Ontario. Of course, it was done on Broadway, so it's been done in New York State, but I don't think it's been done anywhere else in New York. And so that's an enormous audience who are really in for a treat, because it's one of those plays that most comedies are not very funny on the page, but then you see them and you go, oh, I get it. But even on the page, reading this, you're thinking, oh, that is good. That's really good. Oh, he's going to fall down those stairs again. I love it. I'm in for that. You know, it's a very, very silly comedy. It's shameless in the right way. And, you know, I remember I've directed Amadeus twice. And one of the things that I love about Mozart and Shakespeare is that neither of them is afraid of being a bit vulgar. And One Man, Two Governors is just vulgar all the way through. It's absolutely like a saucy seaside postcard, you know. And Peter Fernandez, who's one of our funniest and most delightful actors, is going to play the James Corden role of Francis. And he's a fantastic ball of energy and silliness. So I think the audience are going to be fairly helpless in his hands. And then, of course, Sherlock Holmes, as you know, is our part three in our trilogy of Sherlock Holmeses. We never planned a trilogy. I just did it in my second season and immediately went, oh, right, should have thought of this sooner, because it was a big hit. We did Hound of the Baskervilles. Then we did the Raven's Curse a couple of years ago. And then this year we're doing, for the first time, we're doing a premiere. The Mystery of the Human Heart's never been done anywhere. And it's written by a rather mysterious chap called Reginald Candy, and nobody knows who he is. Mm. So, so it's rather, there's a mystery about that as well.
Perfect. The mystery starts before you even walk in the theater. I love that. At the Royal George, which is in the center of town, which is kind of like a beautiful, like old world, wonderful proscenium stage. You have Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution, The Secret Garden, The Orphan of Chow. Did I say that correctly?
You did.
Wonderful. And Candida. Agatha Christie, Witness for the Prosecution, was a famous movie starring Marlene Dietrich. It's coming to the Shaw stages. What can you tell us about it?
Well, Agatha Christie is the answer to a rather interesting trivia question, a couple of trivia questions, actually. Best-selling author in the world in human history after the Bible and Chairman Mao, Agatha Christie. And most performed female playwright at the Shaw Festival, Agatha Christie. It's one of the things that when I got here, there were certain pendulum swings that had happened. And one of the pendulum swings was away from the traditional murder mystery that had been a staple of Christopher Newton's time. And it immediately became apparent to me that there was a gap in the market for that pendulum to swing back, that people love a well-plotted mystery. You look at all of the series now, like Knives Out and Glass Onion and so on. We all love it. We love being fooled. We love that moment where you go, oh, of course. Oh, the clues were all there and I didn't see them, you know. So one of the things that I think a festival like ours can really explore is genre. So, because the genre is a sort of pure form that allows you to observe the artist at work. When you know, for example, One Man, Two Governors is a farce, then you're observing the artistry of the playwright. You know what he has to do. You know that he has to add a complication here. You know that he hasn't yet. You know that it's too early in the second half for it to start being solved. So we're good. And so you watch in a rather sort of beautiful way, like watching someone make an instrument. You get to watch in real time the artistry of the farce maker or the murder mystery maker or the thriller maker or the ghost story maker. You know, these are all genres which, particularly for our audience, I think, very satisfying because they know the actors involved. So they get to say, okay, let's see you now as a suspect in a murder mystery, or let's see how you play the straight man in the farce, or let's see how you play the unwitting blunderer into the abandoned manor house, you know. So there is something, again, the fixed and the flowing, there are certain conventions in these genres which are fixed, but how the convention is satisfied can flow. And indeed, every now and again, as long as you do it carefully, the convention itself can be played with, and then the audience gets a more exciting jolt because they were so sure that they knew where the convention was heading. So as soon as it takes a left turn, they go, but wait a minute. So, you know, all of this is, the other thing about genre is that it is, in all of those cases, it's about a live experience. I mean, I say people like Knives Out and so on, but it's not as much fun as being among an audience that is gasping with realization, or an audience which is going, oh, or an audience which is falling about laughing because this farce has just been whipped up one stage further. All of these genres actually, again, in a rather functional way, they judge their success by audible responses from a live audience. I like that.
I will say that in seeing Gypsy this last year, I was shocked because it seemed like, oh, everyone sort of knows this. And when Rose says, my daughter can do it, the audience gasped as if they had never seen it before. It was so thrilling for me to see, as someone who in stock once played the back end of the cow in the sort of dance sequence. It was thrilling to sort of see that it was still so new. The Secret Garden is a new production.
Yes. And one that I'm really excited about and passionate about because, you know, I love the book. Everyone who's read the book loves it. And there is a musical of it. And a lot of people think, you know, oh, you're doing the musical. And I say, no, I don't mind the musical, but I think it's overrated, to be honest. And what I wanted was for Paul Sportelli, our head of music, and Jay Turvey, one of our stalwarts who acts every year here, but also directed Gypsy this year. I wanted them to make a new adaptation and really root it where it happens in Yorkshire, because the folk music of Yorkshire is so stunning. I mean, the example everyone knows is Scarborough Fair, that I said, why don't you make it a play with songs, not a musical, and dig up as many Yorkshire folk tunes as you can and let them be marbled through the piece. And what they've come up with is really gorgeous. It's the singing will make you cry shamelessly.
Wonderful. And I was reading this morning, and I think it's incredible, The Orphan of Chow, that's also a new piece or a new adaptation for the Shaw Festival. Is that correct?
Yes, it's one of our younger actors, Michael Mann. I got talking to him about The Orphan of Chow because I directed it way back when at a drama school. And I said, what a good play I thought it was. And he said, yeah, I love that play. So I said, go on then. It's a lunchtime. We can afford to take a bit of a risk there. We don't make any money on our lunchtime shows anyway, but it's a great little 11:30 hit of drama for our hardcore theatre hounds. I think they'll really love it.
Fantastic. And then finally in the Royal George is the Bernard Shaw piece, Candida.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's been about 13 years since Candida was done. I was asked yesterday whether it's Candida or Candida, and I have no idea. So,
well, we covered both. You and I covered both.
We can use them interchangeably.
Perfect.
But it's actually one of his most popular plays. Looking back here, it's always done really good business. It's a very charming love triangle with a typically Bernard Shaw kind of twist. As to Bernard Shaw's always a bit odd about sex. It's always there, but he's always trying to pretend it isn't. I think that makes the plays quite sexy, actually, because it means that you just sort of go, Why is everyone pretending that lust isn't playing a part here? You know, because it is. And actually, that's a lot to do with Shaw's own personality, that he himself was always, he was full of rubbish about that. He would say, you know, oh, I doesn't matter. I plays no part in my life. It's not interesting. And yet he was forever being jumped on by women who had crushes on them, on him. And he tended to oblige them when they jumped on him. So, yeah, so he was full of shit, really. But it's a very charming, very funny, very embarrassing play in the best way.
Fantastic. But we move then to a smaller theater on the space, the Jackie Maxwell Studio. Just because it's smaller doesn't mean it packs an incredible punch, because you're able to be so close to the performance and the actors and see everything they do. The first play there that I saw was The House That Will Not Stand by Marcus Gardley, who is in the news right now because he wrote the screenplay to the film version of The Color Purple, an amazing playwright. What can you tell us about The House That Will Not Stand?
He's a really interesting playwright. He really engages with the past and with other works of art. And I think that's one of the things that does mark us out. Almost every single piece we're doing next year is based on something else, is an adaptation of something. One Man, Two Governors is a Goldoni play. Witness for the Prosecution started life as a novel, so did Secret Garden, etc. So there is something in all art deals with the past, of course, because it, by the time you make it, it's already past, and somehow it usually refers to something that happened even longer ago, sometimes very long ago. The House That Will Not Stand is in relationship to Lorca's great play, The House of Bernarda Alba, which is a very brutal, beautiful but brutal play about young women locked up by their mother and not allowed to discover their sexuality and fulfill their passion. So this is set in New Orleans in 1850, so it's antebellum, and it's set among a family of freed black women. So they're in a very unusual situation in the South, that they're free black women. But of course, they're not free in most social senses, and their mother is aware of that and is very Christian and is trying to stop them going astray, like the mother in Bernarda Alba. So it sets up a very, very red-blooded, melodramatic, overheated, deep South atmosphere where you just know that there are going to be explosions, and boy, are there.
Mm. Wonderful. Also in the Jackie Maxwell Studio is Snow in Midsummer. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, also based on something. This is a Chinese-American writer, Francis Lee Cowig, who did a version of The Wrong Done. What's it called? It's called The Injustice Done to Du Yi That Offended Heaven and Earth, or something like that, the original Chinese legend. And it is a great... it's in that great theatrical tradition of, you know, going back to Oedipus, of the detective story where you're trying to work out what crime happened in the past that is now leading to the plague that afflicts our city. And it's a really fabulously plotted piece, because you genuinely, at a couple of moments, you genuinely go, oh God, no, oh no, oh, I see. Oh, I see. And, you know, again, these are very satisfying moments. But it's a very clever new version of it as well, because it also, it includes some subplots and elements to the story that wouldn't have been in the original. I won't say more than that.
I love throughout our entire conversation, we've been talking about plays. We've been talking so much about feeling what we're seeing, as opposed to sort of seeing it or observing it or Even the word enjoying it, although people will absolutely enjoy these plays, but they take something away. There's a richer experience that you've been talking about with the entire 2024 season. And I also think that people are going to be able to feel if they go in the aforementioned Spiegel tent, which is showing the Shaw Variety Show, Role of the Shaw, Cabaret, and Cotton Club. Can you tell us a little bit about the amazing experience of the Spiegel tent and some of the concerts and events and kind of spectacular offerings that are going to happen in that?
As your listeners all know, of course, Spiegel is the German word for mirror. So a Spiegel tent is a mirror tent, and it has lots and lots of mirrors. It has lots of stained glass. It has velvet draped swag tent shape, and a wooden, lovely wooden floor and a little wooden stage at one end, and booths that you sit in to quaff your drink. The mirrors again make it quite a naughty space because you can look at people without them catching you, and you can catch someone's eye in a mirror, and it's a bit like being at a masked ball. You know how I've never been to a masked ball, but I've been to theater events where you wear a mask, and there's something naughty about that as well, that if you catch someone's eye in a mask, you hold it, you don't feel so shy. It's the same here. You catch someone's eye in the mirror at the Spiegel tent and you just go, oh, hello. Are you going to look away or am I? And so there's a sort of risque sense to the Spiegel tent, which of course makes sense of the history of Spiegel tents. They were invented for burlesque and strip shows and so on. So there is a kind of late night Berlin in the 20s feel about them. That's why one of the shows we're doing is called Cabaret, with the
Thank
double
you.
T, because it's Berlin in the 20s. The Cotton Club is Harlem in the 30s. So it's all of these kind of underground, you have to know the special password to get in sort of events. The Shaw Variety Show is I've just lobbed that to some of our naughtiest and silliest members of the company and said, come up with a kind of Spiegel tent equivalent of a late night TV show, you know, with guests, with songs, with stupid human tricks, with quizzes, you know, whatever it's going to be. So that will be a really, I think it's really important. We're trying to get more and more two-way theatre going. Now, that doesn't always mean audience participation. I mean, it can, but it doesn't have to. But what I do think it means is that after you've been to the show, you go to the Spiegel tent, you meet other people that watch the show that you've just seen, you talk about it with them, you meet some of the actors you just saw in the show who are also drinking in the next booth, and you can have a chat with them. And you know, the breaking down the kind of solid wall between us and our audience has been really my mission since I got here 7 years ago.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, this summer when I was or went to the Game of Love and Chance, which was in that venue, which was like a sort of beautiful, I don't know, I was sort of feeling like I was in a beautiful music box when I was inside of it. I hadn't maybe utilized the mirrors to their full capacity, but there was a sort of an older couple with me at the table, and my friend who just sort of raved about the Game of Love and Chance and had come back again to see it again because it had shifted or changed, and they had loved the experience so much that they just couldn't say couldn't sort of tell us enough about it, which was a wonderful experience to sit with them.
Well, of course, the Game of Love and Chance was totally different every time because it was entirely improvised. And we don't have one of those next year, but we will in 25. We'll have another improvised play in 25. But it is one of the joys of doing a completely improvised play is that people come again. We had one couple who came to see the Game of Love and Chance 23 times.
Wow, that's amazing. TC, those are my questions. Thank you so much for your generosity. Before we end the interview, I always like to ask, is there anything that you feel was left unsaid or anything that you'd like to share with our listeners before we close our call?
I'd really love your listeners all to get a season's pass, because, and not just because we want your money. In fact, we make more money out of you if you just buy separate tickets to everything. But I really feel as though the people that get the real value of the Shaw Festival are the people who come to everything. and take a chance on the thing that they don't think they're going to like. So take a chance and come and see a show that you have no reason to go and see, and let it surprise you.
Fantastic. I will say that I am definitely getting a season pass myself, because every time I went up to the Shaw this last year, I thought, oh, I saw that. Well, now I want to see this next thing, or now I want to see the Edith Wharton play, or now I have to see the Tom Stoppard. So it just kind of kept growing. And I thought, I'm just going to invest in the season pass for next year and just make sure that I'm able to see everything. TC, thank you so much for your time and your generosity in this interview. It was really great to speak with you. Please have a great day.
Thanks.
I had a great time talking to TC, and hope I'm able to chat with him about the 2025 season in a year. As I mentioned, I will definitely be buying a season pass, and I'm certainly going to see Cabaret in the Spiegel Tent. If you'd like to do the same, go to shawfest.com for more information. This episode was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Addison Schoonmacher engineered this episode. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides, posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like this show, please recommend it to a friend. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios.